Please be seated. The next and last case on calendar for this session of the en banc court is Zhang v. Reconstruct Company, case number 58602. Mr. Gerard, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, good afternoon. My name is Douglas Gerard of Gerard, Cox & Larson. I'm here representing Reconstruct Company, Countrywide Home Loans, and National Title Company, and Silver State Financial Services. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, Countrywide's arguments in this matter are very simple and straightforward. First, Countrywide has a pending equitable subrogation claim that still must be adjudicated by the District Court that has never been decided. Second, Mrs. Zhang's specific performance judgment still requires her to perform her obligations under the purchase contract by tendering the purchase price. Third, Zhang can't be considered a prevailing party and an award of an attorney's fees determined until all claims have been adjudicated. The parties agree with respect to equitable subrogation that Countrywide paid off two prior loans against the property in the amounts of approximately $230,000 and $50,000 for a total of $281,000. The parties also agree what the interest rate was on those pre-existing loans. The two prior loans also were secured by deeds of trust, which were properly recorded before Zhang ever entered into a purchase contract with Sorochetti in February of 2004. There is no question that these earlier deeds of trust have priority over any rights that Ms. Zhang may have had to purchase the property. Equitable subrogation, as a legal or an equitable remedy in this case, was raised in the joint pretrial memorandum that was filed by both parties prior to the trial. There was a dispute between the parties as to whether equitable subrogation should apply or should not apply, which was covered in the trial briefs that were submitted by the parties. Equitable subrogation was argued extensively at the trial, and we've noted in our moving papers that not only did James' counsel argue about why equitable subrogation should or should not apply, in your case should not apply, but also Countrywide's counsel extensively argued at the trial. The district court decided Countrywide's favor at the initial trial, that it was based upon an alternative legal theory, that simply being one of priority based upon what the chain of title, the public record, reflected. And as a result, the district court did not feel that there was any need to include any order with respect to the equitable subrogation claim. Ultimately, this court, in an order of remand and reversal, reversed the district court's decision. Judge Williams, in his July 12, 2011, hearing on our motion to reopen the trial and enter final judgment, very specifically stated that he had not ruled on the equitable subrogation claim because he had made a decision based upon a matter of law based upon a legal issue of priority, which was an alternative theory to get to the same result. As a result, he was trying to figure out whether he had been given jurisdiction in the order of remand to now entertain that remaining claim. He determined that based upon the specific language of this court's order, he did not have that jurisdiction. The district court entered an order granting in part and denying in part the motion to reopen the trial. And in that order, he specifically stated that he omitted making a decision on the equitable subrogation claim because he had ruled in favor of my client on purely legal grounds. In the motion to alter or amend that took place in December of 2011, the district court judge once again made it clear on the record, and we've cited these portions in our brief, that as far as he is concerned, the equitable subrogation is still pending, that he does not feel that he has the jurisdiction to entertain it without further order of this court. Now, the response that we've received to that, both in arguing in front of the district court judge and in the briefs before this court, is that the law of the case doctrine in some way stops us from proceeding on that claim. We think that the most recent decision on law of the case, which was prepared and written by Justice Hardesty and joined by Justices Perry and Pickering, that being the Dichter decision, makes it clear that under the law of the case doctrine, only an estoppel will only apply to issues actually raised and actually decided in a prior appeal. We know from an exhaustive search of the previous record that there was never anything briefed or argued in the last appeal with respect to equitable subrogation. Nor would there be any need to, because that was not the issue, that was not what had been decided by the district court judge. So there would be no need to have briefed an issue that was not decided on an alternative claim. The argument that's raised, obviously, is that somehow, even despite the fact that it was an alternative claim that wasn't ruled upon, that it becomes somehow incorporated into the appeal or should have been incorporated into the appeal or should have been raised in the last appeal. As a matter of public policy, is that where we want to go? Do we want to require an exhaustive appeal on issues that the court doesn't reach because they have found on an alternative theory in every instance in which that occurs, which is often? And I would submit that, of course, we don't want to do that. For reasons of judicial economy, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But certainly, if you read the Dichter decision, which is the controlling authority in Nevada, the law of the case doctrine does not apply when the equitable subrogation was neither raised in the district court judge's order, was never raised in the appeal, and remains outstanding. Now, second, we have this outstanding issue about the specific performance. We submit to this court that the district court judge didn't read correctly the order that this court issued, or, with all due respect, that maybe it could have been worded a little bit more clearly than it was. What is at issue in the underlying case? Certainly was a priority issue, as with respect to whether my client's deeds of trust had priority over Jane's purchase rights under a contract. And their priority is based upon the list pendants that they had recorded. And this court determined that they felt that my client had constructive notice of that list pendants and as a result of Jane's purchase rights. We're not disputing that. But that's what was at issue in the last appeal. There was never briefed in any pleading that we can find nor argued the premise that because title was being quieted vis-a-vis that priority issue, meaning the quiet title declaratory relief claim that Zhang had brought was being granted in Zhang's favor, and this court was ruling specifically on page 6 of that order of remand, there is language where this court says, quote, since it was error for the district court to conclude that the deeds of trust had priority over the Liz Pendens, the district court's determination that title could not be quieted in Jane's name because of the priority of the deeds of trust on the property was also an error. That sentence makes it clear that what was at issue in front of the Supreme Court was that priority issue, the deeds of trust versus the Liz Pendens. And nothing more. And that's what the quiet title action was about. It wasn't about actually transferring title to the underlying property into Jane's name without Jane performing. Obviously, an elemental part of any specific performance claim is the performance element. You can't have the property without actually performing, albeit with whatever offsets you have for your damage claims. So, with respect,
what does the record show those offsets are? Like, let's assume we accept your position that she'd not paid the purchase price. The district court did award her,
it was something in the neighborhood of $230,000. I don't remember the exact number, but we've never disputed that number, and it is in our brief, and I could hunt them.
And that's an appropriate offset against what she would have owed Sarah Ketty, or I don't know how you pronounce it.
Well, again, we're not taking, we're not disputing that, because the court already found that, and we have not appealed that.
Right.
So there is an offset, without a doubt, but again, there still would be required to be a performance, a payment of the purchase price. And what's interesting is But if you look at the record of what's happened in this case, when the plaintiff brought their equitable, I'm sorry, their specific performance claim, obviously they didn't plead that they were entitled to the property without paying anything. They made a specific performance claim. They've never argued, not once in any motion up until the time of the last appeal, or during that last appeal, that they were somehow entitled to title the property without performing.
Is the amount of the payment more than the equitable subrogation claim?
Yes, Your Honor. The amount that they were required to pay, as I recall, was 500, let me find it.
It's 500 something, but then it's less the offsets.
Correct. There is $532,500 was the amount they were to pay, less the offset, which was 200 and something thousand.
And the equitable subrogation claim is only as to?
The equitable subrogation claim would be for the $280,000 that we paid to satisfy pre-existing liens.
The first deed of trust?
Correct, which would put us in a priority position as to $280,000. And we've also asked for whether we're...
That would net out with what's due from her on the purchase price after offset.
Potentially. It depends on how, Jane proceeds on that, obviously.
Right.
But, and again, we don't know what the current value of the property is. We hear, argument about what it is, but there's no current evidence.
So bottom line, what is it you're asking us to do in this appeal?
Well, what we're asking for is two things. One is to allow this to go back to Judge Williams so that he can actually enter a ruling on the equitable subrogation claim. And second, we're asking for whatever specific performance rights that Zhang has required them to actually complete the purchase of the property with whatever offsets Judge Williams has already ordered. And I'm not sure I didn't see my time. Is this my time with...
Yes, sir. You're chewing up your rebuttal time.
Then I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Justice. Scott Markey and my partner, Mike Echols, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Lan Wen Zhang. If it may please the court, the title company's appeal in this matter should be denied for three primary reasons. First, the law of the case doctrine and the scope of this court's remand during the prior appeal preclude the title companies from requesting equitable subrogation again. Second, the title companies have effectively waived or forfeited any right that they may have had to request equitable subrogation. And third, even if this court were to allow equitable subrogation to proceed, it shouldn't do so here because such a claim would be futile, where in this case, equitable subrogation is not justified because Ms. Zhang would not receive a windfall, and because Zhang was an innocent party would be severely prejudiced by the application of the equitable subrogation doctrine. And even if this court were to allow equitable subrogation to proceed, this court should limit the amount that could be claimed by the title companies for equitable subrogation to only that sum that Ms. Zhang would have to pay to Mr. Sorcetti in order to close the transaction pursuant to her purchase contract, given the two different judgments that have been entered against Mr. Sorcetti and the associated interest on those judgments. First, it needs to be noted that the title companies certainly had the right to raise equitable subrogation during the last appeal. As counsel stated, it was argued during the trial, and both parties had made presentations in that regard. This court's holding in Ford versus Showboat specifically stated that a respondent may, without cross-appealing, advance any argument in support of the judgment, even if the district court rejected or did not consider that argument.
As the equitable subrogation, did parties fail to argue or did the district court preclude that argument?
Well, it's our position, Your Honor, that the district court did preclude that argument because the title companies actually submitted a proposed judgment that had findings and rulings with respect to equitable subrogation in that proposed judgment, and the district court removed those findings and those rulings from that judgment. And according to this court's...
But weren't those unnecessary given the district court's decision to give the title company priority? so they won across the board anyway, so why would the court make the equitable subrogation findings? I think that's their point.
It is their point. And, but once again, Your Honor, that's an alternative remedy. And they've described it in their brief as an alternative claim for the same relief.
An alternative smaller claim. It's a sort of a lesser included.
Exactly. But under the Ford v. Sherbrooke case, they certainly have the right to raise that argument to advance the judgment during the last appeal. And, in addition,
well, how could they without a factual finding as to equitable subrogation? I guess you're saying they should have had a fallback. Well, if you're going to credit Zhang's appeal, at least remand for determination of the reserved equitable subro claims. Is that what you think they should have done?
Well, actually, all of the facts were before the court in the last appeal. I mean, all of the facts necessary to decide equitable subrogation were, in fact, before this court. The parties had made the arguments during the trial, and they were all part of the record on appeal. In fact, even the order of reversal and remand states that this was a refinance transaction that had occurred. So obviously, as a refinance, there's some sum that had been paid previously to a previous deed of trust holder here.
What about the policy argument that you don't want to be litigating unnecessary issues?
Okay. I completely disagree with that argument. I think that other courts and this court have completely disagreed with that argument as well. This court stated in Polk v. State that a respondent who fails to include and properly argue a contention in the respondent's brief takes the risk that the court will view that contention as forfeited. And the Ninth Circuit, in similar fashion, has found that they need not and do not consider a new contention that could have been raised but was not raised in a prior appeal. And the Ninth Circuit has also stated that adherence to the rule that a party waives a contention that could have been or was not raised on a prior appeal is, of course, necessary to the orderly conduct of litigation.
Did your appeal ask that this court not only reverse the ruling as to the priority, but also extinguish the reserved equitable subrogation claim?
Or could, or briefs on the prior appeal, on our position on the prior appeal, did argue that we wanted title quieted in Zhang's name. And our claim for quiet title specifically stated that Ms. Zhang was, quote, entitled to possess a property and have title quieted in her name. As such, we were asking for the court to quiet title in Zhang's name versus any claim that the title companies may have had to the property. If I can finish with your question real quick, the courts have also stated that failure to follow the rule that an appellant or that a party raised any argument that they could have raised during the prior appeal would lead to the bizarre result that a party who has chosen not to argue a point in the first appeal would stand in a better position than a party that chose not to argue that right during a prior appeal. And essentially, the policy argument is that what happens is parties will keep coming up before this court. If we don't encourage parties to put everything on the table in the first appeal, especially an appeal from a final judgment, then we're looking at potentially successive appeals that could number, much more than two or three even. And this court has to then get itself reacquainted with the facts of the case in each one of those occasions, instead of just dealing with all the facts and circumstances and the parties' claims in one single appeal. It needlessly expands the costs to the parties to bring these cases, and it needlessly expands the number of cases that this court has to hear. The simple fact that one case may be a little bit more complex during one appeal, I think it is far outweighed by the fact that there could be successive appeals, and this court would have to decide on numerous different occasions and become reacquainted with those facts in those cases on numerous occasions. And it's because of these arguments that this court has held that when a reviewing court determines that the issues on appeal and versus judgment specifically directing the lower court with respect to particular issues, the trial court has no discretion to interpret the reviewing court's order, whether it's bound to specifically carry out the reviewing court's instructions. And in this case, this court gave very specific rulings to the district court. It ordered the court to quiet title in Zhang's name, to enter judgment in favor of Zhang's list pendants having priority over the respondent's deed of trust, and to make a single determination of whether attorney's fees and costs are appropriate in light of the court's order. And it needs to be noted that the parties had substantial briefing with regard to that issue, what determinations were left for the district court to determine. In the initial order of reversal and remand, this court said that it would be remanded for a new trial. Both sides said that that issue should be readdressed by the court because neither side knew what the new trial would be concerning. And in the en banc order denying reconsideration, this court stated that the only issue that it was being remanded for was a determination of whether attorney's fees and costs are appropriate in light of the court's order. As such, according to this court's holding in the Wycliffe versus Sunrise Hospital case, a lower court can only take such actions as conform to the judgment of the appellate tribunal. It has no authority to deviate from the mandate issued by the appellate court, and proceedings contrary to the mandate are null and void. As such, the district court here had its hands bound, and it did the appropriate thing by refusing to consider the arguments of the title companies for equitable subrogation. And the title company's reliance on the Dicta case is misplaced here. As the Ninth Circuit recognized in the Cellular 101 case, an appellate court does not have jurisdiction over all claims and defenses during an interlocutory appeal. And that's what the Dicta case was. It was an appeal from a summary judgment. It's a different story when there's an appeal from a final judgment that determined all the claims of the parties, as it was in this case.
Mr. Markey, could you comment on United States versus Moran, for example? The First Circuit held that the duty of the appellee to raise an alternative issue supporting the judgment is only required in cases in which the judgment can be supported. Since equitable subrogation is a completely different theory than the law-based decision that was rendered by Judge Williams, was appellee really required to raise that alternative theory on appeal under that holding?
Well, this court has stated in the Ford v. Sherbert case that a respondent may, without cross-appealing, advance any argument in support of the judgment, even if the district court rejected or did not consider the argument. The title companies themselves have said that this was an alternative claim for the same relief. And realistically, it is an alternative claim for the same relief because what the title companies are requesting now, equitable subrogation, the amount of $281,000 plus interest, they say that the value of the property isn't determined. There was an appraisal of this property during the negotiations for during the settlement conference, and that appraisal that was done by the title companies came back at $300,000. Prior to this litigation with the title companies, Ms. Zhang had offered to pay the equitable subrogation amount at a time when the property was worth $780,000. She could have closed escrow at that point in time when she got her judgment against Mr. Shorchetti and made $250,000 on the resale of this property.
Would that argument be cognizable in the district court if we were to remand for a determination of the equitable subrogation claim?
It certainly should, Your Honor, but I would implore this court to consider the facts that are before it at this point in time. Ms. Zhang has been involved in this litigation for 9 years now. It's been almost 7 years since the title companies have been brought into this litigation. It's time for this litigation to end. If you go back down to the district court, it's guaranteed that it will be back before this court again because neither side will likely be happy with that judgment. And the facts are all here. We understand what the value of the property is, what it was at the time that the claims were brought against the title company, what it is now, the damage that has been incurred by Zhang, the $480,000 in lost equity in the property. All of those issues are before this court at this time. This court has the ability to make that decision if it decides that equitable subrogation can be brought by the title companies at this point in time. Now, I want to go back to the waiver issue for just a second. The Ninth Circuit has stated that it doesn't really matter what terms you use here, whether you call it waiver or forfeiture, or that the parties are stopped from making the argument after remand, or even that the law of the mandate or the law of the case prevent the party from raising the argument. They all basically have the same purpose, to avoid relitigation of claims the parties had the opportunity to present during prior appeal. But even if this court were to look at a regular waiver analysis here, clear that the title companies waived this right. The title companies certainly knew that they had the ability and the right to argue equitable subrogation during the last appeal in accordance with the Ford v. Sherbrooke case, and as a defense to Zhang's quiet title action. Yet, they failed to argue equitable subrogation in the last appeal. They argued instead that they would receive nothing if this court upheld Zhang's claims. And they acknowledged that the order of reversal and remand had provided Zhang with exclusive title. They acknowledged that there were no other issues to be determined on remand. And they acknowledged that Zhang was a prevailing party for months after this court remanded the decision. And I've given the court a short handout on that shows that from the time of the order of reversal and remand on February 26, 2010, the title companies took the position for over a year that Zhang was the prevailing party in the case, that she had received exclusive title to the property, and that there were no decisions on remand other than the attorney's fees and costs issue. In fact, in the motion to retax costs, the title companies freely admitted that Zhang was a prevailing party. Their only argument as to why she should not receive costs was that she hadn't filed the memorandum of costs within 5 days of this court's order denying en banc reconsideration. In addition, a month later, in their reply in support of that motion to retax, they specifically stated that Zhang was entitled to over $14,000 in costs as the prevailing party. And a month later, in their opposition to Zhang's motion for attorney's fees, they again stated that Zhang was the prevailing party, at least with respect to two of the defendants in this case. So for over a year, the title company said that Zhang had been granted exclusive title, that she was a prevailing party, and that there were no other issues to be determined on remand besides Zhang's fees. Now, if I can just real quick talk about equitable subrogation. First of all, there's no windfall in this case. Ms. Zhang is paying $532,500 for a property that is worth $300,000 now. She already has $300,000 in judgments against Mr. Sorochetti. Your Honor, the first judgment against Mr. Sorochetti was $256,000, I believe. The second one that was just entered during this last remand was a little over $40,000. It combined for about $300,000, and with interest, there is slightly over $400,000. So she's already paying $100,000 more than the property is worth at this point in time, and she's going to have to pay another $100,000 or so to close escrow on this property. There's no windfall here.
So you acknowledge that she still has the purchase price?
We've never not acknowledged that, Your Honor. Actually, in the hearing on the motion for fees, we actually stated we opened escrow at that point in time. We had opened escrow, we planned on closing escrow. It was afterwards, after the motion to reopen the case, the court took this real literal reading of this court's ruling and decided that they wanted to quiet title and things known in that order. We've always believed that we needed to close escrow to obtain the property.
So why do you care about the equitable subrogation claim if the purchase price would go to that in any event?
The equitable subrogation claim that's made is $281,000 plus interest. The value of the property is $300,000. Ms. Zhang will only have to pay Mr. Sorochetti about $100,000 to close escrow.
But as to that $100,000, you don't have a dog in the fight.
We really don't, Your Honor. We really don't have a dog in the fight. The other parties that have judgments against Mr. Sorochetti, there's probably a dozen parties that have judgments against Mr. Sorochetti. They may have a dog in that fight. We really don't, though. So that $100,000, you're correct. Finally, just this court held that equitable subrogation will not apply when a party, when it's inequitable and prejudicial to an intervening lien holder. And that was this court's holding in the American Sterling case. And here, Zhang's the only innocent party. The title companies failed to properly protect their security interests. The title companies inflated their claims, essentially, by demanding that Zhang pay the two prior deeds of trust. They refused to accept equitable subrogation both before this litigation began and even after this litigation in an offer of judgment. They prevented Zhang from losing or enjoying her property for over 6 years. They objected to all requests that the court provided title and allowed her to take possession of the property. And they did that even though they never had a claim to the possession or title of the property themselves. All they had was a claim that they had a deed of trust that they could later foreclose upon if it hadn't been satisfied. But they still prevented Ms. Zhang from obtaining title to the property or using her property. And Zhang has already lost more than $200,000 in equity due to this appeal, and the title companies are even seeking an equitable subrogation. For that reason, equitable subrogation is just not appropriate in this case, and it would comply with this court's holding in the American Sterling case to disregard equitable subrogation here. And finally, just as I said before, Your Honor, if equitable subrogation is granted, it needs to be limited to only the sum that Ms. Zhang has to pay to Mr. Shortay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. George, just a question to follow up what Mr. Marquis just said.
Sure.
Would you acknowledge that Ms. Zhang's received no windfall on this based on the tortured history of this case and the decline in real estate values? What windfall has she received?
Certainly, I think that everybody's been disadvantaged by the decline in real estate values. I mean, we all have to acknowledge that.
Mm.
But the fact remains that at all times, Ms. Zhang's right to purchase the property was subject to $280,000 of pre-existing liens against the property.
Mm-hmm.
My client paid those liens off when they funded these loans.
Mm-hmm.
If Ms. Zhang is allowed to take title to the property without being required to satisfy what she would have at all times been required to satisfy to purchase the property, that's a windfall. And there's no escaping that fact. I mean, we all feel that.
What about the actions of your client, though, when the real estate market was at a peak that blocked her efforts to close escrow and take title of the property, where maybe she could have sold it and maybe paid the $281,000 and still made some money in between? Didn't your client act inequitably by not allowing that escrow to close?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think that the answer is as was represented.
Mm-hmm.
We've never blocked them from taking title of the property. They could have exercised their right ever since they got their judgment from Judge Williams 4 years ago to close escrow. They just didn't do it. I mean, where is there anything in the record showing that they were stayed from moving forward and exercising their rights? And we'd have been thrilled if they had sold the property and escrowed the money so that we could lock in the higher value of the property. The record is devoid of any support for that argument. Even now, they've never closed escrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been 2 years since the remand, and they've never closed escrow. And I was thrilled to hear them acknowledge to Justice Pickering's question that they think they have an obligation to close escrow, because that's exactly the opposite of what they just argued to Judge Williams, which is why we're here. One of the reasons that we're here.
So there are no exceptions to marketable title now that would have precluded them from closing escrow?
Well, none that they didn't, bargain for in their purchase contract. I mean, whatever is there, they agreed to take subject to, or they didn't in their own purchase contract, which has nothing to do with us.
Right.
The only thing we're saying is there were pre-existing liens. We paid those off. They didn't do that. That was always was going to have been an obligation they would have had to satisfy, as any of us buying a house would have the obligation to satisfy the pre-existing liens if we want a clear title, right? And so is that the fault of the lenders who put up this money to pay off the pre-existing loans? Of course not. We're not trying to unnecessarily delay matters. We'd like this resolved as much as Zhang would. But again, the fact remains Judge Williams made a ruling as a matter of law on a specific issue. We thought he was right. This court disagreed, right, with respect to that priority issue as it related to just whether the list pendants provided constructive notice. That delayed things for quite a while. We're not blaming Zhang for appearing that ruling and the delay that caused. And Zhang, by the same token, can't blame us for trying to exercise our own legal rights to try to, to get whatever we can get back out of a terrible situation. I mean, these rights exist. We've acted no more inequitably than they have. You could make the same argument to them. If they had closed escrow years ago, maybe this case would have been over. But they didn't, because they were trying to take advantage of, I think, some unfortunate language in the last order, and so here we are.
Mr. Gerard, what's your position with regard to counsel's interpretation of Ford versus Showboat and its holding?
I don't think that that's correct at all. I mean, I think that Your Honor's decision in Dichter, which is consistent, by the way, with the First Circuit decision that you just made reference to a few minutes ago, makes it clear that, and to quote that language, the doctrine, meaning the law of the case doctrine, does not bar a district court from hearing and adjudicating issues not previously decided. And does not apply if the issues presented in a subsequent appeal differ from those presented in a previous appeal. The decision that counsel referenced does not take away from that decision. It's not inconsistent with that. He's reading something into the decision that's not there. The point of dictor, as was at the First Circuit, is you can't be held responsible or stopped from making an argument that was never decided upon before. It was never raised in the previous appeal. And that's what the law of the case doctrine says. And we're not asking that that doctrine be changed. We're simply saying it does not apply here because it was not raised. As was pointed out in response to Justice Douglas's question, Judge Williams never made a decision on the equitable subrogation claim. And he tried to make a really clear record of that for all of you once we had the case on remand. He stated several times that, right, that he had never decided that issue and that he specifically took that language out of the order. So, any other questions that I...
Well, I thank both sides for very good briefs and oral argument. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
This case will stand submitted and will be in recess.